Natural Living with Gary Null, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. For those of you who have not heard this show in the past, and I have to assume that there are people for the first time listening each day, I try to focus in upon the issues that generally are not given a lot of attention within the mainstream media. For instance, today we're going to talk about what are the additional dangers of nuclear reactors and radiation from all different sources. That's in one part of our program. Then we're going to talk about the causes of America's breast cancer epidemic and the dangers of combined chemical exposures and radiation, with so many women falling victim to breast cancer today. It's time that we took a realistic look at what really is causing us for people to make these issues more important in their mind. So that's what we're going to focus our attention on. Before we go there, I would normally spend the first 7 to 8 minutes of the program talking about the latest in health nutrition update. Instead, I would like to do a very brief commentary concerning what lessons I believe that we can learn from this latest election. Recently, I attended a rally at Madison Square Garden for Ralph Nader. 90% of the people in the audience were probably 16 to 18, 19 years of age. When I saw the marches, and I was down in Washington for those marches, the average person, I'm going to suggest, was in their low 20s. In Seattle, challenging the New World Order, the average person, again, was in their low 20s. I didn't see people in business suits. I didn't see baby boomers. I saw very, very few senior citizens. When you take a look at all the important environmental issues, even when it involves a person directly, people living around the Savannah, the Hanover, the Hartford, and many of the other nuclear power plants, very few of those people are actually out protesting. Many of them work for the very companies that are destroying their lives. If you go back and look at the Kerr McGee episode with Karen Silkwood, she had a very difficult time trying to inspire and motivate her co-workers who were also being exposed to the effect of this radiation and to get them involved. Historically, it has been primarily the alternative media. Programs such as Michio Kaku's excellent program and other non-commercial radio stations that have informed you that these dangers exist and to the extent that they exist, and trying to find those experts who are qualified academically to give an opinion so that if there is any media paying attention, they might interview these people. You almost never hear the mainstream media relying upon an alternative person for expertise. It is very rare. And if you do so, it's never that person being interviewed as if their word were enough on its own. They always have to be supposedly counterbalanced with an orthodox point of view, generally a spokesperson for one of the major industries. And yet, when something is said about a breakthrough in AIDS, a breakthrough in cancer, a breakthrough in anything, it is always with the orthodox and never counterbalanced with an alternative expert. When I look at how many people in my own audience I asked in lectures over the last year, who are you going to vote for and why? It was either Bush or Gore. I'm talking about my own audience. Probably 95%. A small percentage, very small percentage, were going to vote for one of the alternative candidates. And then when I ask them, why are you voting for these alternative candidates? They didn't even know the platforms. They didn't know what the person stood for. They just weren't the same as the Democrat or Republican. When we've had progressives who've wanted to make substantial and meaningful change to the military-industrial complex, to the food and technology complexes such as George McGovern, Muskie, they have, across the board, Jerry Brown, got no support. In fact, if you took the last 20 presidential candidates who have offered really intelligent, well-thought-out approaches to solving many of the world's conditions, put them all together, and they wouldn't have gotten 10% of the vote. What does that tell you? What does it tell you when today 95% of Americans did not see the significance of the issues raised by the alternative positions? What it tells me is that we have not been looking at the right part of the problem, and it requires a rethinking. It requires a rethinking on the part of Ralph Nader, on all the other people, and don't assume for a second that Nader would be the next Green Party automatic shoo-in candidate. There's a lot of people out there, I believe, who are even more capable because of them not making some of the mistakes that have been made this time. I believe that we are a nation filled with fear, and that because we are virtually paralyzed at one level by our fear to make choices that would liberate us, to look at social issues, local issues, that would allow us to dress properly and with courage, racism, sexism, corporate corruption, government corruption, IRS corruption, FDA corruption, pharmaceutical corruption, the New World Order, NAFTA, GATT, environmental pollution, human rights abuses, trading with the enemy, all these important issues. But even though we can recognize the issue exists, doesn't mean that we are going to attach any energy to it. Now, what I found was the answer, at least it puts it in a different perspective, is when you can help a person change their fear into non-fear, it's like asking a person, do you want to be healthy? And they say, yes. And you say, but let's start on being happy first. And they say, no. How likely is it for a person to be healthy if they're not going to be happy? I don't believe that's possible. I believe that the underlying character and the underlying energy that the person manifests everything from has to come from something that's rock solid. And today we are living lives of rice paper. We are extremely fragile, extremely volatile. But we're all doing, not all, but the majority of people are doing the same thing. They are, instead of dealing with their anger, their pain, their frustration, and I believe it's because their essential needs are not being met. I believe that that's why people go to drugs, children will commit suicide, people will work hours they shouldn't, people will take on responsibilities they can't possibly achieve and maintain balance in their lives. And what gets left out of the equation? Anything that would cause them to risk their self-esteem, as fragile as it is, risk putting time into a major or minor social or community effort instead of into filling up the void in their life. We are absolutely preoccupied with a void. The average American is spending over 7 hours and 43 minutes a day watching television. And yet that person will not know what's going on in Sub-Saharan Africa that's going to cause 5 million people to starve to death this year. Nor will, in all likelihood, they care. They won't care that a lot of kids are going to go to jail for the next 10 to 20 years and be raped and brutalized simply because they took a drug, because there was something in their life that was missing. No one's going to ask what was missing. The jury won't, the judge won't, the prosecutor won't, the police won't. The probation officers won't, the prison guards won't, the warden won't. The self-righteous people who moralize and are clueless about true morality or spirituality will sit in their pious and pompous church pews or synagogues as if they knew something about the spirit. They know nothing. But we can't be honest about any of this, because the last thing we want in our society is to hold a mirror up to what's really wrong. Because if we were willing to be honest, we'd say, you do not punish someone for making a choice that was the inappropriate choice, and not at the same time ask, what role did society play in creating that choice? You cannot blame drug addiction upon the people who grow the poppy or process the cocaine. That is equivalent to saying that the only reason we have drug addiction is because we have available supply. The fact that we have strychnine doesn't mean we take it. The fact we have bridges that without safety nets doesn't mean that we're all jumping. When essential needs are not being met in a person's life, people will turn to something to alter or alleviate the pain. And whether that alteration is in the form of alcohol, nicotine, sugar, chocolate cakes, or cocaine or crack, shouldn't be viewed as a moral issue, and hence a legal issue. It should be viewed for what it is. A life choice that can be corrected if we offer compassion and sensitivity and try to correct these, but we're not willing to do that because our own lives are filled with so much pain. And when your life is filled with pain, you're stressed, and when you're stressed, your choices are almost always reactionary without reason. And without reason, we'll vote Democrat or Republican. We'll vote for the big issues. The media will only focus upon issues that are sexy, and the subtlety, the essential issues get missed. So don't be frustrated when you think, why were people so limited in what they could see would come from the choices they made? Those people are voting merely an extension of their pain. Don't look at the politicians as being the problem. They're not. They're part of it. Don't look at the media. McCune made a mistake when he said media is a message. Only partially true. That's like blaming everything on television for why your life doesn't work. Your life is far more significant than the programming of a television. We have to start looking at what's wrong in our basic development and our character development and how we support each other through our crucial and essential stages of life and what happens when we miss some of that development. We're not asking that average baby boomer is going to have 10,000 of their children commit suicide this year. Only when it's their child will they question what went wrong. But they won't question the 6 million baby boomers' children who will be told that their kids have to be put on Ritalin or Prozac. They won't question 93% of all mass homicides that were committed by people who are on antidepressants. They won't question the nature of the mental health care system. They won't question the authority of the doctor. They won't question 33 different vaccines by the age of six. They won't question any of this stuff because they're not questioning the own fallibility within their life. So having another party will not change anything. You could have Greens for the next 20 years. It will not make a difference. The average person will only change how they vote and how they react to social, national, international issues when they can react appropriately to their own inner demons and change the dynamic of that to face, confront, and embrace their fears and insecurities so they're no longer stressed to the point where they require sublimation that denies them the virtue of a larger life more meaningfully connected to other people. I cannot blame the media nor the politicians for being the primary problem. Our belief system is the primary problem. And that is something we have yet to challenge. I might mention, however, that just as an example of this, in the last year alone, I track the number of people in our health support groups who started with political persuasions, which I asked them on one level, and by the time it came that they had finished making transformations in their own life, they saw that their original proclivities were limited to reaction, and now they were using reason in making their choices and social commitments. So we can change. Absolutely. We just have to have a new directive in how we approach this, or the political system will not change. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to thank everyone who's tuned in today. Let's go directly to our program. My first guest, first of two who are going to talk about the government cover-up of dangers of nuclear reactors and radiation, is Dr. Jay Gould. Dr. Gould is a statistician, a member of the EPA Science Advisory Board during the Carter administration. He founded in 1985 the nonprofit Radiation and Public Health Project, and he is the author of two books, Deadly Deceit and The Enemy Within. And Gould is now conducting the Tooth Fairy study that we had Dr. Sternglass on to talk about. Let's go over and say hello to Dr. Gould. Nice to have you with us today, Dr. Gould.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Gould, from what areas in the country are you collecting baby teeth and why? And what levels of strontium-90 are you finding in the teeth of children?
Yes, well, we began in the New York metropolitan area, starting with Suffolk County, moving on to the areas around Indian Point and the Oyster Creek Reactor down in southern New Jersey and Dade County. And the reason for starting there is that in all those areas, there were enough concerned and affluent citizens who were able to raise the money to test the strontium 90 levels in baby teeth. It costs about $100 a tooth, so we really need money from people who are aware that there is a problem. And what we found in the course of testing 1,500 baby teeth from those areas was that the levels we found were as high as they had been back in the middle 50s, 1957-58, when concern about the strontium 90 in the atmospheric fallout moved Barry Commoner to begin his own first baby teeth study, in which they collected something like 60,000 teeth and found that the levels had risen from 1949 from about one-tenth of one picocurie per gram calcium to a peak of 11 in 1963, just before the termination of atmospheric bomb testing. So what we find is that at least for families living near nuclear reactors, we're faced with a similar problem, and we should have a similar national concern.
Dr. Gould, I'm getting a very bad connection on the phone. Are you on a regular telephone?
Yes.
Okay.
Is this better?
Yeah, a little better. What were you doing?
Well, I wasn't speaking directly into the...
You got to speak directly into it or we can't hear it. If we can't hear it, then we have no message to give you to raise funds, all right?
Okay.
Now, we also want to speak with one of the people who's also helping in your group, and that's Joseph Mangano, who's research director of the Radiation and Public Health Research Project, and he holds a master's degree in public health from the University of North Carolina, and also from Fordham University, and he's written 12 articles published in the medical literature, and also he is the author of Low-Level Radiation and Immune System Damage. And we're going to go to him in just 1 second. Dr. Gould, why should a person be concerned about how much strontium or low-level radiation they're exposed to? What could be some of the side effects that we have not associated with this impact?
Well, what happens is that when a mother ingests a high level of strontium 90, it goes to the fetal bone of the developing embryo if she's pregnant. And that at that stage, the embryo is extremely vulnerable to any toxic agent, including the emissions from strontium 90, which Dr. Sternglass talked about on yesterday. And at that, and therefore, the we have found, this is what was found by Barry Commoner back 40 years ago, that the level of strontium 90 in the mother's diet could be measured by what is found in the baby teeth the child loses at the age of, say, 6 to 12. And at the time that the first baby teeth study was done, the levels had risen to so high a point that President Kennedy was moved to speak with President Khrushchev to terminate above-ground testing as an indication of their recognition of the terrible dangers of such high levels of strontium 90.
Okay. I appreciate that insight. Hold on, Dr. Gould. We'll come back to you. I want to go over now and say hello to our other panelists. Joseph, thank you for being on the program. How are you today?
Very well.
Good. Joseph, what is the goal of your study regarding radiation in children's teeth, and what exactly have you discovered up to this point?
Well, Dr. Gould began to talk about one of the goals, and that was to, first of all, get an understanding of how much radioactivity is in people's bodies. We haven't known that for almost 20 years now. At one time, the government had funded three different studies, two on bone and one on baby teeth, and defunded them all. So we're really looking to get an understanding of how much radioactivity is in people's bodies, especially those living near nuclear reactors. Now, we're in the process of doing that, and as we do, we're trying to seek out answers to the real question. Are these levels harmful to people? Do they, in fact, raise the risk of disease? And even though our study is still progressing, we've already come up with some answers. Suffolk County, which is on Long Island in New York, is the area in which we've collected 563 teeth so far. And we have found in a medical journal article just published in the International Journal of Health Services that the higher the amount of strontium 90 in baby teeth at birth, the greater the chance of being diagnosed with cancer before the age of 5 years old. We've also found this in Ocean County, New Jersey, which is the home of the Oyster Creek reactor. There are fewer teeth involved here, maybe like 130, so we need more to ascertain this, but we found the same thing. And we've also found in Suffolk County that the greater the radioactivity in the teeth, the more likely a baby is to be born either at a low birth weight or a high birth weight, both which have risks. I think we're all pretty familiar with low birth weight risks, especially that of dying or developmental disabilities and so on. But also high birth weight has been connected with childhood cancer for many years. Researchers don't really know why. We think this may be a clue. So this is something we are going to pursue. And not just with cancer, we're going to look at other diseases as well. But this is the real point of the study, to determine how harmful these emissions are.
Do the federal officials monitor the release of radioactive fission products in the environment? And if so, why aren't we made aware of it?
The federal government does monitor two out of three things they should be monitoring. The first is emissions from the nuclear power plants. They do this on an annual basis. They get reports from each utility that runs a nuclear reactor. Unfortunately, until they published data that were easily available to the public until 1993. Now they no longer publish it. To get this information, one has to call each of the 72 utilities running nuclear power plants around the country, which is quite unfortunate. The second thing that they do is collect data on the amount of radioactivity in the water, in the air, in the food, and the milk as well. Again, unfortunately, the EPA back in 1990 cut back the amount of measurements severely. They used to take monthly readings of three radioactive elements in milk in 60 cities. It's no longer published. It's available, but it's very, very difficult to get your hands on it. It would take hours and weeks to do so. The third thing that they should be doing, again, measuring radioactivity levels in the body, they just don't do. Like I said, they gave up on this almost two decades ago. So we have the government looking at two of the three things, but not very available to the public. The unfortunate upshot of this, Gary, is that these data are very important in assessing whether or not a nuclear reactor should be allowed to operate and continue operating. But when these decisions are made by federal regulators, they are absolutely not consulted at all. The party line is that if a reactor has released radioactivity below federal standards every year, then inherently there is no harm and the reactor should be permitted. The government does no health studies assessing whether these low levels of radioactivity are harmful or not. And we feel that's inadequate.
Then, do officials in other countries monitor radioactivity released by reactors?
It varies by the country, Gary. In the first world, typically Western European country, they have systems much like America does. In the third world, is a different story. There are some reactors now operating in Asia, in the Middle East, and so on, in South America. These countries typically have very, very loose to non-existent.
Gary, about 40 years ago, when we had our own baby teeth study, about two dozen other countries followed suit. They all got the same results, namely that the highest levels were registered in the middle 60s, just before the, just about when the tests were terminated. But thereafter, it died off. After 1970, the U.S. stopped measuring baby teeth. But what is very interesting is this. We have recently been consulted by the Chinese, who are very much worried about problems of energy and environmental control. And they have invited us to assemble a group of experts to come to China and gather information, including asking them for 1,000 baby teeth from places near their three operating reactors in the southern part of China, and another 1,000 from very remote areas. We're proposing to measure their strontium 90 levels without knowing where the origin of each tooth is, send them the results, and let them make the decision. But if they do that, they will be the first and only country in the world today that will be measuring the uptake of strontium 90 in humans from reactors. And if that influences their decision to skip the nuclear stage and go on to a solar transition, they will be the first country in the world to literally abolish pollution and poverty at the same time.
What do you feel should be done in the United States so that we become more aware of the potential dangers and real dangers of these nuclear plants and other forms of nuclear radiation that we're being affected by?
Well, we made two new discoveries, at least I think. We have found that in every area that is threatened by nuclear emissions, people who live there are aware of it. And often they include affluent celebrities like Alec Baldwin, Christie Brinkley, who are great supporters of us. But what we discovered only 2 weeks ago in White Plains at a meeting that Joe gave, in fact, I wish he would talk about it, we discovered that the county officials, county legislatures, are very much concerned about this problem because they feel that their own elected positions would depend on it. They do not have the constraints that are exercised on state and federal officials because of the power of the nuclear establishment. But that is what we're going to do. We're going to move from one area to another, and in each case, appeal to the county legislature for the funds necessary to do our work. For example, in the Oyster Creek area, after Alec Baldwin and Christie Brinkley went down three times, they raised the consciousness around that area to the point where the New Jersey legislature appropriated $75,000 for our baby teeth survey in southern New Jersey. Governor Whitman, out of a multi-billion dollar budget, chose to veto that tiny item as an indication of what happens when you permit state officials who are under the thumb of the federal authorities. But at the county level, we think that is where we can operate most effectively. I think that's a major contribution to our understanding of how to rouse the consciousness of Americans to this terrible danger to all our children.
Good information. Well, I appreciate the energy that your group is putting out. I know that you've been consistent, and you have provided press conferences, and I know that Alex Baldwin has set aside a lot of time and energy to help moderate these and to bring his a celebrity presence to at least interest a lot of people who would otherwise not be interested. So Dr. Jay Gould and Joe Mangano, thank you very much for being there. And let me mention that you can go to www.radiation.org for more information and also for social activist issues. You can then see how you'd like to help these groups bring more information to the public, and also those of you who can get baby teeth to them as well. They will also benefit from that. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm going to thank you both for being on. We're going to take a station ID break. We'll be back with more program. Please stay with us.
And good afternoon once again. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free Community Radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up at 1 o'clock will be The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille. And on today's program, Armand will be looking at the magic of touch. So you want to stay tuned for that. 2 o'clock, a special from the Public Affairs Department. At 3 p.m., talk back with Utrice Lead as we continue to look at the outcome of Election 2000. Behind the News at 5 p.m. and the WBAI Evening News at 6 p.m. Back to Natural Living with Gary Noll.
I'd like to welcome everyone who's just joined us. I'm Gary Noll. In this segment of our program, a very important issue, and that is the real causes of America's breast cancer epidemic. We've been led to believe that it's just smoking and sunlight and genes, and that's it. Of course, then there seems to be this question, what about all the people who don't smoke, are not exposed to excess sunlight, and who cannot show a genetic predisposition who end up with breast cancer? That's just a trivial argument, they claim, and set it aside. It's not trivial for those of us who see that we're swimming in a sea of toxins, stimulant hormones, things we've never had before in our bodies. The other side of the coin is that recently there was a march against breast cancer in New York City, in Central Park. Thousands and thousands of women participated. So I decided to join in the march and to ask some of the people what their views are, to see what part of the problem they understood. So I was asking them, if you were told that you would have to substantially change your lifestyle in order to protect yourself against breast cancer, would you do it? The vast majority of women said no. They also didn't believe that lifestyle really had a whole lot to do with outside of smoking. They felt that their best approach was tamoxifen. To prevent it, take a drug. When I pointed out that I had reviewed virtually all the world literature on tamoxifen, and it could not be protective for people who have never had breast cancer, there's no science to show that at all, and that for women of color, which represented about 90% of the people in the march, it could increase by 300% ovarian cancer, they weren't aware of that. They still said that they were not interested in major lifestyle changes. They didn't want to change their diet or whatever they were doing. That seems to be a common phenomenon now. We don't have to change anything. We'll simply wait for the scientists to create a vaccine or a pill, something that will not make us feel uncomfortable at any point in this journey. Well, that begs the issue, can we really then prevent breast cancer? The answer is, in those who care, yes. In those who are not willing to make these changes, no. I've invited Dr. Jeanette Sherman. She is a physician specializing in internal medicine and toxicology. She worked in radiation and biological research at the University of California, and she served on the EPA Advisory Board for the Toxic Substances Control Act and advised the EPA on the dangers of pesticides. In addition, she's been an advisor to the National Cancer Institute on breast cancer. She's the author of the new book, Life's Delicate Balance, Causes and Prevention of Breast Cancer. Nice to have you with us today on the show, Dr. Sherman.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you.
As you know, almost nothing was discussed in this past major election campaign about what really could be done to prevent breast cancer, and virtually zero discussion on the role of pesticides or anything that could cause soft money contributors to wince or feel uncomfortable. And I'm very concerned that the new administration will have no more advantage in trying to correct some of the problems with our environmental exposures than any previous one. I want you to address that first, and then let's talk about, is there an increase in illness in the U.S. population, and if so, what kinds of illnesses have increased and why?
Well, I share your concern about the new administration, whichever one it is, because as pointed out by Mr. Nader, they are both awash in money. And where does the money come from? Largely from industry, the chemical industry. And certainly, there's no incentive to cut back on pesticides. I think it's only through programs like yours where people become educated, that they have to understand that they have a choice between the health of themselves and their children or a weed-free lawn. And I think they have to understand as well that it may cost more to buy organic food, but you have to make a decision. How would you rather spend your money, on organic food or on medical care? So both of these issues, I think, require education and thought. Now, excuse me, what can be done? I think it's only through public pressure. I mean, what got women the vote was public pressure. What stopped the Vietnam War was public pressure. And what brought around civil rights was, again, public pressure. Through programs and education, we can, I hope, help people to understand why there is such an epidemic of cancer. In 1940, 1 in 22 women would get breast cancer. Now it's 1 in 8. And some areas in the country, it's even higher. And the chemicals, the endocrine disruptors, and the radiation fallout that's fueling the breast cancer epidemic is also fueling the prostatic and testicular epidemic in men and cancer in children. We have got to make choices. Either we will go broke financially trying to support the medical community and see our citizens die premature deaths, or we have to do something about it.
How has there been an increase in breast cancer? And in other words, what do you see as the primary causes of our increase in breast cancers, and especially on Long Island?
Well, Long Island is quite unique in that it has a sole source water supply, which means that every pesticide used on Long Island over the last 50, 60 years and currently in use, chemicals that have been dumped, dump sites, gasoline stations, et cetera, go into the water supply. So you have three factors mainly on Long Island. You have the pesticides and toxic chemicals. You have the endocrine disruptors, which includes breakdown products of such things as DDT, PCBs, dioxins that are given off of incinerators. And most importantly on Long Island, you have it crisscrossed by at least four nuclear reactors from Millstone, Haddam Neck, and the Indian Point reactors, plus the leaking reactor at Brookhaven. So it's a deadly mix of chemicals, endocrine disruptors, and nuclear radiation.
Okay, but let's go into more depth on that. How do we know? What evidence exists?
why they're getting more breast cancer?
Yes.
Well, we know that the epidemiological studies have shown a change in the incidence of breast cancer. We know that for instance, in a study that was recently published in the European Journal of Oncology, that there are 19 cases of rhabdomyosarcoma in children, 9 of them within 10 miles of the Brookhaven National Laboratory. And that same area has increased strontium 90 levels in baby teeth that have been collected in the area. And the same area also has elevated levels of breast cancer. In another study that I'm a consultant on in the New Paltz area up the Hudson River, a number of women who have undergone breast biopsy either for benign or malignant disease have had a concurrent fat biopsies done, and measurements have been made of such pesticides as DDT, DDE, chlordane, heptachlorin, PCBs. And to nobody's surprise, the women with malignant breast lesions have higher levels of these chemicals than the women with benign lesions. But this has already been shown by workers previously in the United States and in Israel.
But why is it that the American mainstream media, and certainly our government agencies, has not been more aggressive in trying to see whether or not there is a cause and effect? They've dismissed this as anecdotal and unreferenced in the scientific literature, so they're not making any policy changes.
But it is referenced in the scientific literature and in the peer-reviewed literature. But what, you know, you have to ask, who owns the government these days? Well, you know, we have to bow to the pest control companies, the chemical companies, and the pharmaceutical companies. I'm always astonished when the news comes on in the evening. I call it now the pharmaceutical hour, because seems to be a pill for every single ill, rather than coping and learning how to deal with issues and prevent illness. So these are the companies, and these are the groups that are supporting the Congress and the president. I mean, we've seen, my goodness, we've seen how much money has gone into the most recent election.
And close to $400 million.
Yes, it's outrageous. And where is it? It's not coming from individual citizens. It's coming from big corporations and special interests. And they're not going to want to see any changes made. I think earlier in the program, Mr. Mangano was referring to the data that are available, but how difficult it is now to get it. And if the government wanted to do something about it, they would make the data easily available.
What are the factors from your research? Now, I'm going to give you a three-part question. What are the factors that are causing cancer and diabetes and asthma in humans? And what happens when a person is actually exposed to a combination of toxic chemicals and ionizing radiation? And give us a comprehensive view, at least as much as we can in the next 18 minutes, because I'd like us to have a better understanding of this synergistic cocktail that we're all consuming. Even those who try to be conscientious are still breathing the air outside and still exposed to a lot of this.
Well, we certainly know that the combinations of radiation and toxic chemicals is far more dangerous and potent in causing cancer than any one of those, than either one or any one of them alone. And that has been known for decades. And the one of the first persons who spoke to that whole issue was Rachel Carson in her Silent Spring, which is now 38 years old, and we still have not heeded her lessons. There is an increase in cancer and diabetes and asthma. Certainly the interior use of pesticides is one of the major factors in the rise in asthma and in asthma deaths. Now, I've treated asthma for many, many years. I've been a licensed physician since 1964, and asthma used to be relatively easily treated. And if a person avoided whatever they were allergic to, they generally did well. Now we are seeing children dying of asthma. But if you're, instead of controlling, for instance, ants or roaches with barrier methods, if you're spraying your entire house and your child is crawling around on the carpet, more than likely your child is going to wind up with asthma. There has been recently an article, actually a governmental study, saying that the government has finally agreed that, yes, veterans exposed to Agent Orange do have a higher rate of diabetes. Well, what's an Agent Orange? 24D and 245T. Now, 245T has been largely banned, but 24D is the commonest pesticide used on lawns and golf courses. So this should also come as no surprise. I cover all of these issues that you've been asking me in my book with lots of documentation. And I generally say to people, don't take my word for it. Go to the internet, look up these things on the internet sources, and convince yourself that this is not fantasy, and it's well documented.
Let's take us through what happens to the immune system, because that's the level that everything's happening.
You're right.
Take us on a journey. Explain the immune system in a way that people in this audience can understand and appreciate it.
Well, the immune system begins to develop in the fetus while the fetus is still within the mother's womb. The immune system begins in primarily inside the bone marrow. Well, you heard earlier that when a mother is exposed to strontium 90 in her food or water or milk, strontium 90 goes to the bone marrow, goes to the bones and radiates the bone marrow. The strontium 90 breaks down, and as it breaks down, it gives off a powerful beta ray, which essentially radiates the cells that are in the bone marrow, which are the beginning of the immune system. Chemicals such as chlordane and DDT and PCBs also go to the bone marrow because they're fat-soluble, and the bone marrow is relatively gelatinous and has fatty tissue in it. So you have a combination of chemicals and radiation which are harming the bone marrow and the immature immune system. After the child is born, those chemicals are still there, and the strontium 90 is still there. So there is more impairment of immune function. Plus, then the child gets exposed to many chemicals in his or her world. Plastics. We've learned recently that the plastics in pacifiers and baby bottles are causing immune abnormalities, which should, you know, we should teach women that if they're going to use bottles to feed their babies, they should use glass ones. And these are the kinds of things that are built up, you know, gradually, little by little, till it pushes over the edge and the child either develops immune dysfunction, asthma, cancer, and other problems.
Now, why don't we talk for a few moments about what happens when a person starts to change this, because we have to look at children who are very vulnerable to chemical and radiological pollution. And I don't believe, since people can generally not see a lot of this, and sometimes you can't even taste it or smell it, it's hard for people to imagine something could be bad for you that can't be, you know, viewed. I mean, if you woke up each day, I used to live in Weirton, West Virginia, across the river from Steubenville, Ohio. Your car, if you washed it in the morning, in the afternoon, it would be covered with a red soot. Everywhere you, if you went out and come back at night and you were out in the daytime, you'd have to shampoo your hair. And when you'd look down at your feet, you'd see this red stuff going out of the shower. And I remember there was a man named Kit Carson, who was a director of research at Weirton Steel. And I was an inventor, and I was trying to show them an environmental creation I had that would clean up the smokestacks with some special magnetic brushes that had not been invented at that point to put into their smokestacks. They were very interested in what I was talking about. And I spent the better part of 3 months living up there. And I said to him one day, I said, "Don't you all get bothered by this?" I said, "You can taste it. You can smell it. Your kids are playing in the grass." He said, "We get used to it. And besides, what are you going to do? These are the people that we earn our income from. We don't allow protest. And the first time anyone protest, it wouldn't be the bosses. It'd be the workers that would tell them to shut up." So I want people to realize that we're dealing with this on many different levels, including we cannot wait until we see our environment soaked in the sky with pollutants, that there's pollutants there like radiation. You can't taste it, see it, or smell it.
That's right.
So take us on the journey of that kind of pollution.
Well, all of this is essentially invisible to the person who's being exposed to it, whether the chemicals or the radioactivity. So one must make a decision, even though one cannot see it. You have to make a decision. Do you want to doom your children and grandchildren to lives of illness and early death? There is more than enough evidence out there of the seriousness of the massive amount of pollution that we are encountering. It's not just human illness, but we have deformed frogs. We have seals with tumors. Currently, over 50% of the fish in the Anacostia River, which dumps into the Potomac River just south of Washington, D.C., have cancer. So it's not just humans who are getting cancer. The fish, crayfish, across the globe, we are destroying our world. And unless we make decisions that we will not buy those products, we will boycott those companies that are polluting, nothing will get done. I think it
now,
has...
When you say we, which we are you talking about? Because
individuals.
Okay, there's a difference, because the average person is fully aware the pollution exists.
Right.
But they're not going to do anything about it.
Well, that is a very serious problem, because if the individual is not going to do anything about it, and certainly I don't think we can depend on the government to make changes, we are in a very precarious position in this world. I feel that we have got to spend much more time in trying to educate the public, because I think the government will not, and people really have to learn how to change.
Let's talk just a few moments about children. What do you see as the primary cause of the, or let's put it a different way, what conditions do you believe are now manifesting in children that we did not have in the past due to those children being exposed to things in their environment that are toxic?
Well, we're seeing an increase in children with learning disabilities. We're seeing in kids with autism. We have some evidence, and nothing conclusive yet, that there is an increase in autism in close proximity to two different nuclear power plants. We're seeing an increase in social dysfunction in children, and a high rate of suicide and drug use. And as you pointed out earlier in your program, their lives are not comfortable these days, and they're surrounded all the time by this, by that, with the idea that their problems can be solved by acquiring another item in their lives. And I don't know what it will take to educate the American public. It may be too late. I don't know. I hope not.
I don't think it's too late. I just believe that we have to start, in effect, we have to start all over again for the average person and go back to some of the basics and start to question everything at the level where the problem originates. I appreciate you coming on and sharing your insight today. And if people would like to get your book, Life's Delicate Balance, I'm assuming it's available everywhere?
It is available. It's also a website, www.lifesdelicatebalance.com. The words are all strung together. I thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Janet Sherman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Gary Noll. We have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to take you on a journey of some of the latest in health and nutrition update that I didn't have a chance at the beginning of the show. From the Associated Press, from H. Joseph Herbert, citing risk to children, the government and manufacturers agreed Thursday to phase out the use of one of the most widely applied pesticides because of concern that it poses health risks to children in homeschools and parks. Still, the product may remain on store shelves until the end of 2001. And then we have to ask, why? The Environmental Protection Agency announced that it has banned the use of the pesticide chlorpyrifos, commonly sold under the trade names Dursban and Lorsban, for virtually all non-agricultural uses, and curtailing its application on some crops, including apples, frequently eaten by children. The pesticide can be found in more than 800 products from pet flea collars and lawn care products to a variety of bug sprays used in homes, schools, and parks, and on residential lawns and gardens. It is one of the most widely used pesticides, with more than 20 million pounds sold annually. An agreement between the EPA and Dow's AgroScience, a subsidiary of Dow Chemical, and five other manufacturers calls for all retail sales to end in 18 months. Now, here's what I'm concerned about. They've now said that there is a pesticide that's used in 800 products, or on 800 products, that's very dangerous to children, that's everywhere, it's ubiquitous, home, schools, parks, on lawns, and of course dogs, cats, children, anyone who's on the lawn where it's been sprayed then takes it into the house on their feet. If something is that bad, which it is, why would they continue to allow it to be sold for another 18 months? Simple. Several years ago, the pesticide manufacturers, through their trade organizations, descended on those legislators they had substantially supported with their PAC groups and got their payback. I was speaking with my brother this morning about 4 o'clock in the morning because I was up working all day and I'm not near a radio or television, so I was not able since I'm on the road. I'm on the road. I've been on the road for a week, and I'll be on the road for another 2 weeks. This morning I was helping a tiny little non-commercial station in Maine raise some funds, and I'm happy to say that we broke all records in the history of the station for 1 hour raising funds. And then overnight, Roy of Hollywood, and then I've got four other stations today, and then I'm lecturing and traveling at the same time. So I'm not near, outside of an airport, of looking at a monitor before I get on a plane. I'm not aware of what's going on. So my brother was telling me why he felt that that they had made some big mistakes by not focusing on important issues. But, and here's the key, but the smart people, the people who really manipulate everything, were the special interest groups and the foundations and the PR firms who look carefully at how much the American public will tolerate on an issue. And here's what my brother said. Stephen's very smart. After all, my brother was the one responsible more than any other person of getting the lead out of the entire country of India's gasoline system. And now he's done it in Dominican Republic. And he's getting the kids' blood tests down there and lead toxicity levels and helping them. So he's an activist that you rarely ever hear about, but doing an enormous amount of good. And he said, the American public has a very low tolerance for negative news that involves them being responsible. They'll tolerate all kinds of negative news as long as it's something outside of them. So when you're asking people to be responsible in the choices they're making in the supermarket or in the hardware store or in building materials or what they drive, they don't want to do that. And they don't want to hear people who are telling them to do it. They won't boycott things because it changes how they buy, which changes how they consume. So the environmental movement, the human rights movement, all movements must at this point, I believe, and he does as well, must stop and reevaluate our entire approach, because just having the facts is not enough. And this is just one example. We're going to allow everyone to be continued to be exposed to a toxic pesticide for 18 months because the manufacturers lobbied legislators, got their payback, so now even when something is shown to be dangerous, cancer-causing, or killing people, there's no immediate ban when it comes to a pesticide because we don't want the manufacturers losing money. That's the power, just that people have not used it on their side yet. I'm Gary Nall. That brings us up to the end of another program. If you'd like a tape of today's show, please call 888-317-2346 and ask for program number 2625. Have a nice day. I'll see you tomorrow.